All right, guys. This is the Deep Dive Special Edition. I'm Rich, fan, obviously. I'm here with my main man, Mike Sempervivi, of the Wrestling Observer, Wrestling Observer Live. And we're going to talk a little bit about Minoru Suzuki, because I could not let May go without Suzuki appreciation and Mike. And we're also going to talk a little bit about CM Punk and his foray into the MMA world again, since that is nigh. And so, Mike, welcome back. What are your thoughts, first of all, on CM Punk? Do you think that second fight happens? Should he delay his lawsuit? Why? Really, that's my question after seeing the first fight. Why?
Well, money, passion. Look, there's no doubt in my mind CM Punk loves to train. No doubt in my mind he loves jiu-jitsu. No doubt in my mind he loves MMA. He just wasn't very good at it that first time around. In fact, he was very, very bad at it against a lower-level fighter. And we've seen that lower-level fighter maybe not be as low-level as we thought he was going to be, because he went out there after that and beat Sage Northcutt, and he's kind of been able to be a little bit of a thorn in people's sides, Mickey Gall has. So good for him. He was able to parlay the fight against Punk and get some hay out of it. But Punk's been training nonstop since then. At least we have been led to assume that, I think, with Rufus Sport. And obviously, Rufus Sport talked a lot the first time around about what CM was doing and how ready he was. And then we saw that punch get thrown and him get dropped and his face afterwards. And it done was what it was now, wasn't it? So we'll see what happens this time around with Mike Jackson, Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson, I think it is, but not one Michael Jackson who fights. This is a different Mike Jackson who fights, and he's also a reporter, not the other Michael Jackson, this Mike Jackson, who's a reporter and a fighter, and he's apparently not very good at either one, but people think he's a better reporter than he is a fighter, and CM Punk's going to fight him. I don't know, man. And this is going to be on pay-per-view, while Alistair Overeem, known for knocking people out, is on FS1. And a lot of people are calling that out and thinking that's crazy. I think that's the best thing, because if Overeem's in a slobber knocker, and odds are whoever he's fighting, he's in a fight where somebody's going to get knocked out, that'll get people excited and want to order the pay-per-view, where then they can have the right to pay money to probably, again, make fun of CM Punk and this guy Mike Jackson fighting on a pay-per-view card. Something tells me this fight with Punk and Jackson isn't something you're going to want to put out there to make people spend $50 or whatever it is now to order a UFC. So they probably did this thing the right way. But I just don't know what to think. He was so bad, and we saw so little last time around that my hands are up in the air. I don't know. And people seem to be indicating that he should be able to beat this Jackson guy. If he doesn't, I mean, you know, that's it. If he does, I guess it just depends on how he does it. Where can you go ahead and get another fight out of him? The UFC contracts are traditional 3-fight deals. And if he does somehow land a haymaker on this dude, knock him out spectacularly, people are going to get a big kick out of that. And maybe you can get, you know, another TV rating out of him or get him on pay-per-view one more time to try to entice a buy. But we'll just have to see. I mean, I don't know what the buzz is like for you or how you feel about it. But, you know, we'll see what happens as the fight gets a little bit closer here. But right now, people are just kind of wondering whether, like you mentioned, the biggest, you know, storyline to this fight so far is he's getting sued by WWE for a defamation case taking place in Cook County when he's supposed to be training every day up in Milwaukee. So we'll just have to see how that goes. If I were him, I'd put it off. But then again, if he is completely, you know, blocked out of this and believes that at least for the initial first couple weeks or whatever, that he is not going to be needed at this trial and his lawyers can handle it, I guess if he's got that kind of, he's got the ability to put those types of blinders on, then God bless him, let him go. But that just seems to be the biggest storyline so far.
Now, with him turning 40 and June 9th quickly approaching, what's his plan B? If you see this as his last best chance to prove he's done enough to prove he's a professional in the world of mixed martial arts, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about Suzuki. And while, you know, he kind of worked in the world of the work shoot for a good bit of his career in addition to pro wrestling, what is the next step for CM Punk? Like, let's say, play it out. Let's say he wins the fight. He has that third fight still left on his contract, most likely. And the lawsuit goes away in a way in which he still has his money. Does he hang it up? Does Dana White hang it up? Does he go back into wrestling? Like, is there any... What's the way forward for him? Because that's I just see him as, like, an independently rich dude, so he could buy a spaceship like Elon Musk, or... I don't know what he's going to do with his free time at the end of this.
Well, it's, you know, he'll be 40 in October. So odds are, you know, is if he does... Look, the only way I think his UFC fight, and I could be wrong about this, but in my opinion, the only way he extends his UFC life is he knocks out the next two guys or he finishes them very quickly. Because from there, I mean, how impressive can he possibly be at the age of 40? I mean, how fast can he work his way, you know, up the line at 185 or 170? I can't even remember what the hell he fights at anymore. But, like, I mean, he's not going to be a contender at the level of any of those guys. So what do you do unless you can put him in there and do one-offs with him and try to get something out of it? Then really, what's the point? You know, he got a chance to live out his dream. He got a chance to train. And because of that, and because of the fact that he is straight edge, he's probably in pretty great shape. I mean, as far as the average man goes, you know, so unless he, you know, lets his body completely go to pot after this, he's probably going to be in really good shape. So I would say if he's got any urge at all to get out there and do something physical, I would, if I were him, just kind of wrestle when I wanted to, because there's nowhere where he would go to say, you know, I want to work for you. I think if you could afford him, you're going to let him work. And I don't think he'll ever go back to WWE. I honestly believe that in the pit of my heart. I believed it when he left. You know, I think Punk, you know, comes across as a real obstreperous prick, you know, sometimes. But I also believe 100% that he would keep his word and not bother with a place that made his life a living hell, that served him a subpoena on his wedding day. All of this stuff that has happened, I really don't think he'll ever go back there. But could he go to All In 2? Could he go to New Japan? Could he go to Revolution Pro in the UK and just say, you know what, I want to wrestle Minoru Suzuki, let's hook it up, can you pay me? I would probably do that if I were him. And again, I don't think he's got to do anything. I hope he is. I'm sure he has saved all of his money, and or at least enough of it where he could do whatever he wanted to forever. But I think if the urge is there to get physical doing something, I don't think if I were him, but I'm not him, but I don't know. I don't think I'd come back for anything regular. I would literally just come back as I felt like it, if there was something special enough to do. And that's pretty much it. But, you know, who knows? I mean, we're hearing, you know, Bilal Muhammad and Rufus are saying, oh, I was surprised we're going to be. But we heard that the last time. But let's say he lands a rainbow on this cat, and let's say he's quickly able to beat somebody, you know, for the third fight. You know, hey, I guess if you get enough eyeballs on it and he's willing to do it again, give him a fourth fight with somebody, put it on TV, see if you could draw a rating with it again. Unless he embarrasses himself or you, if people are willing to watch, I mean, it's still the fight game. It is what it is.
And you mentioned Suzuki at RevPro, and I think, looking at the UK places, I would love to see him in progress, but given their affiliation with WWE, that'd be a little icky, probably.
Yeah, probably, yeah. And it's like, yeah, I could never see him in Mexico, so that leaves Ring of Honor, and that's there, although if I were him, I wouldn't have any affiliation with Ring of Honor. Not that it's anything against Ring of Honor, it's just that, why? know, I would basically just... I would literally just be CM Punk. I mean, it would be like, to me, like Daniel Bryan, when we were speculating about what he would possibly do or could possibly do if he wouldn't have got cleared by WWE and he let his contract lapse and he decided to go out there and try to do something. It's like, you know, unless it was really awesome, I wouldn't latch on with anywhere. I would just appear where I wanted to, because that's the kind of power I think independent wrestlers not many of them, but you know, they're far more empowered now, I think, than they ever have been. And there's so many really stable independent promotions out there, whether it be PWG, AAW, that everybody kind of works with each other, or kind of at least has got a healthy head nod respect for each other for the most part. But still, it's competition for your weekends. So let yourself go to the highest bidder and don't worry about having to deal with anything that would come from being held down, or not held down, but being locked into, say, Ring of Honor or Evolve or something like that.
And looking at what you were talking about when it came to Daniel Bryan and some of these other guys, it's funny to me when people talk about indie wrestling and those guys coming to WWE, a lot of it is they get to take the picture with Uncle Triple H and how proud he is that he's now pulled them out of the wasteland and presented them to the NXT or WWE audience. For CM Punk, that's the last dude you want talking to him if you thought there was a chance on Seven Hells that he was coming back to the WWE.
They'll be turning around. Instead of Paul, I can't feel my legs, it'll be like, you know, Vince, I can't feel my legs, because Punk came up behind him and hit him with a table or something like that. That'd be the only way I think Punk takes a picture with Triple H.
Oh, yeah, it'd be like the Chappelle Show where they started wailing on Rick James's legs on the couch. And they were just all shriveled up. And he's like, they should have never given y'all nothing. And he just start crawling away. That's basically the only way he's going to do that. And I think a lot of people, and I see this, I think I'm down the road when I have more time to get it out, I want to do a deep dive on the passive-aggressive obsession of wrestling fans to prevent themselves being worked. So they say everything's a work. It's like, no. Triple H and CM Punk really liked each other. This whole UFC thing is a big plan so that by WrestleMania 40, he comes back and we got all of us. Or, you
know, that's why this country is in the position that it's in, because crazy people come up with crazy reasons to what about and do crazy things like that. Try to say that Paul and Phillip are good buddies. You need to stop that.
I mean, stop. I was looking on Twitter earlier today, and the biggest example of this, and if you folks get a chance, Conrad Thompson is a great dude. He is a hilarious dude, and God bless him because he has the patience of Job. He
– Alabama fan, though.
Yeah, I know. The Roll Tides kind of get old, but I let him go. He's doing 83 weeks with Eric Bischoff. And there was a tweet stream where someone was like, hey, Dave, I just want to let you know that Conrad Thompson just proved you're a liar, and I used to be an Observer fan. So you take that, buddy, doop-a-doop-a-doo. And then you look up one thing. Conrad Thompson is explaining that he's been a subscriber for 21 years because Dave is the authority on anything you want in knowledgeable pro wrestling information and history being written / recorded. And somehow that was interpreted as, well, Conrad's just following you for gigs. And it's like,
and Conrad's married to who?
Yeah, exactly.
Megan Flair, correct?
Correct.
Who's Megan's daddy?
Some dude from Minnesota.
Okay, yeah, then that dude is
pretty
is
Ricky
always
Rhodes.
Been, yeah, that's it. That cat, I heard, you know, that is pretty friendly and has always been with that Dave guy and with that, like, you know, Mike Mooneyham guy and that, you know, a lot of other guys who, like, could vouch for the things. But I guess we'll put that to the side. You know, because in this day and age, you don't want facts to get in the way of your argument. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you think about it. And the first argument I see, and on the tort side, we don't see it as much. Most of the time, it's someone aimed at Bruce more than Wade. It's usually going to be Bruce, and it's going to be, well, we talked to Pritchard and he said this. And it's like, it's funny how the two guys who are most known for being straight down the middle on stuff are consistently wrong as told by the person who they're saying was wrong at the time.
Hey, PW Torch fans, it's Sam Roberts, the last professional broadcaster, here to tell you about my podcast, Sam Roberts Wrestling Podcast. Every Thursday morning on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on YouTube, notsam.com, wherever you get podcasts, you will find it. Interviews with the A-list of pro wrestling, whether it's Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Roman Reigns, Daniel Bryan, just recently Corey Graves, Mauro Ranallo. They're all guests of Sam Roberts Wrestling Podcast, as well as regulars like Dan Soder and one of my favorite people to talk about pro wrestling with, Wade Keller. Plus, every week we do a deep dive and analyze what's going on in the world of pro wrestling. This week, with the state of wrestling. Bruce Pritchard calls it the best interview in wrestling podcasts. I don't know if that's true, but that's what Bruce Pritchard says. Subscribe now. Get it every Thursday morning across podcast platforms, or get the premium version at Stitcher.com/NotSam.
The person who yells loudest. They usually, you hear their BS the loudest is usually how that works. And the disappointing part, I guess it's not really disappointing, is that, you know, Conrad makes no, you know, doesn't mince any words. He did an entertainment show. Yeah. And Bruce has always, to his credit, you know, anybody, I guess you'd have to be new to Bruce Pritchard to, you know, nothing of what he is saying or how he does it. I mean, it's just, that's him. Like, if you've ever seen him, you know, with shoot interviews and things like that, but it's like kind of disappointing. I was watching the Houston Back to the Territories from Kayfabe commentaries, and I really always liked Sean Oliver's work, and being the alternate and at least somebody that, you know, does shoot interviews that I would actually feel like I could give my money to instead of some other ones out there, you know, that might pretend that, never mind, I won't even go into that. But, you know, he was doing the Houston one with Jim Cornette, and it's like when the BS is to the side and he's just talking about his experiences and talking about stuff, it's like Bruce is very engaging. It's great to listen to his history. I mean, from you know, and obviously he's got his, he is the Peter Burkholz, you know, that situation. There's obviously tension there. If you were to watch it, they do not like each other. Bruce obviously does not like him. So, you know, there's always two sides to every story, usually three, because the truth lies somewhere in the middle. But it's like, you know, I understand why Bruce has always been the kind of the way he is. But it's like, you don't, to me, in this day and age, you don't have to tote that company line so much. And maybe that's truly how he is, to, he remembers things in the exact way. I mean, I guess the line is, you know, Eric Bischoff, I actually legitimately sometimes believe some of the stuff that people think is wacky or whatever it is, but Bruce just makes it up. And I don't know if that's true or not, you know, but it's like, you know, as Conrad said, a lot of it is for entertainment. And I just think, in this day and age, I mean, the constant F Dave Meltzer and all that sort of stuff, it's like, it's really passe, because Dave is not perfect. Wade is not perfect. Bruce is not perfect. There are plenty of people. Nobody's perfect, you know, but like, to dismiss, you know, if a lot of these wrestlers that have dropped dead, you know, I don't want to say they should thank Dave, but it's like, you know, Dave telling the story of some of these guys and their lives and the care and the documentation that he took to that's in the tributes books and his obituaries. It's like, if he wasn't there to do that, who would have did it? You know, a lot of these names, I'm not saying they would have escaped the time or anything like that, but it's like people like Dave and Bruce and Wade and a lot of other people out there too. And I'm just using them as the example now of like, if it wasn't for their passion to mine this stuff, to care about it, to watch it, to be passionate about it, to try to report on it, to try to do these things, I mean, you wouldn't have the ability to go on the WWE Network and babble on the way that you are. You wouldn't have the ability to have this podcast and have people care about it. You know, it's just, that's the way it goes. You know, Dave is a leech off the business. Well, that's all you're doing now is leeching off his, right?
Yeah, it's funny how circular it is. It's this almost a butterfly effect, because you look at it, like I always use it with the Vince Russo stuff. Like, I see a lot of one follow people will throw out, oh my God, it'd be great. It's this Howard Sternization of like pro wrestling. It'd be great ratings if you debated Wade Keller at StarCast, but he won't have the balls. And I was like, oh, you mean like the Ultimate Insiders DVD? They did at the never mind, it's fine, you got it bro, just keep going. And that's why I love doing things like this thing on Suzuki, because I'm not telling people, and we're not telling any of you guys as you listen, like Minoru, well, I am telling you, he is the god king of the spike pile driver and the ability to stare a hole into your soul across a continent, but I will not ever say I am the definitive source on any of this stuff. I the reason I love Minoru Suzuki, and we'll kind of turn towards him so that way we don't burn our time up with the people who don't matter, is because his violence is so different than everyone else's violence in the world of pro wrestling that it's jarring. The first time I saw him, I could not understand why this guy was no-selling Irish whips.
Tell me about it. Tell me about it. And I didn't... It's not that I didn't like Minoru Suzuki. Not that I didn't like Yoshihiro Takayama.
Horseface! Yes!
But they were a definition to me at the time of what I thought was wrong with wrestling in some ways. I remember watching the UFC for the first time, the very first one, and I think the first fight, if it wasn't the very first one, it was like the second one, where it was Gerard Gordeau and the sumo.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember, and it's like, I remember it came on, and I had done a little bit of boxing and some wrestling, you know, that's amateur wrestling. I knew anybody, everybody that had ever had any, I mean, you knew what was going to happen. It was a kickboxer and it was a sumo that was going to rush in, and you knew it was going to happen, and it happened. He broke his eye socket. I said, this is the dumbest shit I've ever seen in my life. This is the sorriest, dumbest, and I was a big boxing fan. How ludicrous is this nonsense? And I liked pro wrestling. I definitely, you know, big difference between the two. Amateur wrestling, pro wrestling. You know the differences. MMA, know the differences. I didn't have a huge Japanese influence at that time. I wasn't reading the sheets. I didn't, you know, my knowledge of all Japan and stuff, most of that had floated through, you know, the wrestling magazines. And for the most part, if anybody around remembers, wrestling magazines didn't really care too much. I mean, if you look at the PWI 500, it's like Keiji Muto would like be like three or four every year, just because it's like, well, that's the name that they knew, so they would put him there. It didn't matter if like whoever it was, Kobashi or whatever, was like the better wrestler or something like that, till like way later on. They didn't, you know, it was, you didn't get coverage. I mean, unless you were really tuned in or had a chance to see like the Pro Wrestling This Week block or something like that. I mean, you didn't really know what was going on with these guys. So there was this whole culture that was forming that I didn't really know anything about. And mixed martial arts was taking place in Japan at the time, and Pancrase and all that sort of stuff. Like, I didn't really understand any of that. You know, it just wasn't on my radar. And then WCW starts to grow. And I mean, we did get tapes from Japan, and that was cool. And I'd see these junior heavyweights, you know, of Liger and Wild Pegasus and, you know, those types of guys, Ultimo Dragon. And I didn't, when I first started getting into Japanese wrestling, unlike most people that got into All Japan and mostly through Dave and tape trading and stuff like that, I saw New Japan. So I saw like Hase and Sasaki and Hashimoto and Chono and Muda. And it's like, one, most of those guys, like a guy like Muda, was tangible to me because I saw him with Gary Hart. So it's like, you know, okay, that was, it was a good, okay, I got, you know, it was a more familiar type of thing. And the style of wrestling, I loved, you know, I loved the junior heavyweights, and I didn't think, and in hindsight, this is different. And believe me, later on, I'll get to, you know, I would probably, my mind changed, but like, you know, Sasaki, you know, hammering Hashimoto or whatever would be like, it was harder hitting, but it didn't feel like when I would see All Japan, which just seemed to be like, just, it was a harder style, and just, it wasn't really my bag. They didn't have a lot of flash. They had their junior heavyweights and they kind of sucked. They were boring and they weren't flashy, and so, All Japan, and I just kind of blew it off. I like New Japan. See Yuji Nagata and Nobu Nakanishi as Kurosawa getting knocked out with Disco Inferno's huge ass fucking ball, disco ball, you know, on Nitro, and watching Yuji Nagata out there, you know, as a TV title contender wrestling La Parca. Like, I love that stuff. And the video games came out around that time, and I was never a big video game player, but all of a sudden it's like we're playing like WCW versus the World or whatever, and like, there's like a Pancrase section with like Boss Rutten. And I didn't know the names. It's like you look up on the computer, like, who are these guys? Like, Boss Rutten and Minoru Suzuki are in these games and stuff like that. But again, they're not. I'm not watching them. So it's like this. It's still not like really real to me. But I know who Yuji Nagata is. I like Yuji Nagata. So like he goes back to New Japan. You start getting in tapes more. You start having the ability to order them and having a bit more freedom. As you can tell, I'm getting a little bit older here and turning like, you know, I guess at this point I'm around like 20. Let's see. When was Nagata there in WCW? 96. So I would have been around 20 then out of, you know, college age. So you have more freedom to order things and check things out and stuff like that. So it's like, man, I loved it. Loved Yuji Nagata. Amateur wrestler. This is great.
Searching for more great pro wrestling talk? Then join me, Jason Powell, host of the free weekly Pro Wrestling Boom podcast. Each week, you'll hear the latest news and analysis from me and my team at ProWrestling.net, along with other Pro Wrestling Media members. Plus, the Pro Wrestling Boom podcast features long-form interviews with notable names in the pro wrestling industry. Subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher, Downcast, and all your favorite secondary apps, or visit us directly at PWBoom.com. Once again, that's PWBoom.com.
Time goes on, you know, and it, by the way, this whole time I have blown off UFC. I think the last UFC I had seen by that point was like 5. I ain't paying any mind to that nonsense. It's barbaric. It's garbage. It's human cockfighting. I'm going to watch these men box and punch each other in the head. That other stuff, that's barbaric. I would never bring myself to be involved in something like that. Time moves forward. Things go on. I move from the D.C. Baltimore area down to the beach. This is around 2001. So around this time, Yuji Nagata, at the behest of Antonio Inoki, is placed into a shoot fight. Now, K1 was being aired on in little chunks on ESPN. What the heck was the name of the show? I forget what they called it. But basically, it was K1 Kickboxing promoted by Scott Coker that were in these half-hour blocks on ESPN. And you would see it. It's like it was very eye-catching because it's like it was really flashy. And it's like this, like whatever's going on here, there's like 40,000 people watching these two dudes fight. And it's like it was heavily edited and it was chunks of like ISK Strikeforce, I think is what it would be called. And it's like something, it's like, what is going on here? And it'd be like, you know, Mirko Filipovic against Stefan Leko. And it's like, this is kind of cool. And it would be over with and that's it. And it was just like, okay. And then Yuji Nagata, you know, he's on his way to becoming IWGP champion. He's a young star. The guy that I liked posing with Sonny Ono and the guy I liked in the WCW video game and the Nagata lock and the salute and everything. It's my man. And he's going for the IWGP title soon. And he's going to be in a shoot fight against Mirko Krokop. Okay. And he gets knocked out and he gets obliterated and he loses. And then all of a sudden, Nagata is Mr. Deadstock. He's a bum. And this is when I found out about Inokiism and what Inokiism was and what was happening with wrestling in Japan. And around that time, I seen the Smashing Machine with Mark Kerr and about pride and his and Mark Coleman and about Kerr's training and working with Boss Rutten and going to Japan and fighting for pride, this crazy organization that was like K1 that was doing these weird, huge shows that involved pro wrestlers and in shoot fights. And I started going back to watch old UFCs and being a former wrestler, I started seeing guys that I had missed because I gave up and thought it was human cockfighting, guys like Kevin Randleman and those types of guys, your Mark Coleman's, those guys started to take over. And I remember seeing that Randleman Boss Rutten fight. I mean, I think that was the one I saw on VHS that said, okay, you know what? I think I'm into this now. I got it now. And I got it. And in Japan, I started to get it and I started to understand it a little bit more. But culturally, it was still tough. But the one thing I couldn't understand was if a pro wrestler wanted to fight, he wouldn't have gotten into pro wrestling. He would have stayed fighting. So if he got into pro wrestling, why are these guys fighting? And I didn't like it. I hated it, in fact, and I still never liked it. They basically killed Nagata's career right then and there. And there's nobody that can ever tell me that the Tadao Yasuda fight against Jerome LeBanner that went on after that was not a work. And everybody says it wasn't. Dave says I'm nuts and everything. Bullshit. I still think that was a work because if Yasuda didn't win, you know, and then he went on to win the IWGP title that should have been Nagata's, and he was the one that won it. It's like he's only the champion because he's a fucking shoot fighter that not even a good one that won a fight. And that was long story, very long story there to get to the point I'm making of like, that's how I looked at Minoru Suzuki. That's how I looked at Takeyama. That's how I looked at those guys where it's like, I like wrestling. I don't like, you know, I like fighting. I like wrestling. I don't need these two intertwined. And I would watch this and it's like, it was very hard for me. It was very hard for me to jive. And, you know, Nakamura was a classic example of this. Shinsuke Nakamura. I loved Shinsuke, the Supernova Nakamura, you know, one of the young lions coming up, the upset of Tenzan. And, you know, now I didn't realize, you know, I was so blinded by being a fan of his, the fact that, again, his whole push is just being rooted in Inokiism. And he goes out there and he gets, you know, does the same takedown attempt against Ignashoff at the K1 New Year's Eve over and over again. And then, you know, Ignashoff timed it, kicked him in his eye, shattered his eye socket. The fight's over. He goes out and a couple days later on January 4th faces Takeyama. And Takeyama, same thing happened to Nagata when he got knocked out by a Crow Cop. A couple days later, he faced Takeyama and he beat the shit out of Takeyama. And what they did with Nagata was to try to get some heat back on him. He beat Don Fry. He beat Boss Rutan. He beat Nobuhiko Takada. He beat guys that were, you know, shooters or that type of thing to rebuild him back up. And he dominated those guys, or at least would look very strong with them. You know, Nakamura went out there and Takeyama kicked his ass. And Nakamura still won the fight, but it's like, this dude's getting brutalized. He's already got a fucked up eye. You've already possibly killed his career, you know, in the same way you've done, Nagata, for what? Because you have a fantasy to live out because you didn't, you know, you didn't get all that you wanted against Ali. That, you know, that's the thing about Inoki fights that, like, Inoki forgot was, like, they were fake.
Right.
And, yeah, you could have taken a lot of these cats. Absolutely. That's the truth, and did, in some cases, have to defend himself. And, and it's nothing against him, but, like, that philosophy of wrestling. And for the longest time, I put Minoru Suzuki in that category, and I certainly put that tag team and called them the Backyarders and was one of those types of people that didn't give him his respect. And, you know, and again, long story to come back around to, you know, when I had a chance to see him in Noah, and that was the other thing too, with New Japan, the difference between New Japan and All Japan to me was always very, very stark. And Noah being an extension of All Japan, I mean, again, I was always a New Japan guy and a New Japan apologist. So it's like my curve to get around to Noah and to get around to what they did and how that style, you know, to really respect that style and those wrestlers, it took time. It took a lot of time. And it was, of all things, I think it was the team with Mara Fuji that he had in Noah where it really... That was the thing, because I never liked, you know, the shoot style of fighting, because, again, my thing with Pancras and a lot of that stuff was if I wanted to see half-assed mixed fighting, it wouldn't look like this. I don't like whatever this is. I don't necessarily like it. I respect it a lot more now. I dig it a lot more now. But at the time, especially, like, I don't like this. You're either going to grapple or you're not. We're either going to wrestle amateur style or we're not. You know, or we're going to pro wrestle. So, like, you know, make a choice here. I could not grasp the mix. And the thing was, Suzuki was doing that mix and doing it amazingly. And him and Kiyoshi Tamura and Josh Barnett, you know, now, but like back then, Volkan, I mean, those guys, what they were able to do in hindsight, I mean, it's brilliant. But what I thought he was doing was like basically being a pain in the ass. Because of the reputation of these guys and because of seeing real wrestlers, you know, pro wrestlers be put to the side for guys who had reputations from fighting, who no matter how many fights they lost, you know, a guy like Suzuki would walk in and all of a sudden I'm supposed to take him like a badass. You know, not buying it. But then when they teamed up with Mara Fuji, that was like the perfect combination, because with him and Takeyama was just out there thumping and bumping, and he was big old ugly, you know, slamming around. It's like, this dude looks like he's really getting hurt and hurting for real, you know, and he was, as we found out later on, you know.
Holy crap.
But, you know, Suzuki, it was like, you know, some of the stuff he did, when he was juxtaposed to me with Mara Fuji, who was so young and so, you know, he and Kenta, yeah, I mean, Kenta was the one who delivered the kicks. Mara Fuji was the one who had more flash. I think if somebody came upon a Mara Fuji now, like, you know, old man Mara Fuji, they wouldn't necessarily believe that. But, like, you know, there was a lot of, you know, flash to him. But his mix with Suzuki was awesome. You know, at a time where it's like when Noah was good, like when Noah was going to the dome, and like, you know, the Sugiura and Kashin against Kenta and Mara Fuji, I still love that match, and they had awesome stuff up top. But like, you know, Mara Fuji and to me, you know, Suzuki as a team, like that's when they finally started to gel to me, and I really started to actually understand him a lot more, and then him freelancing, then from there doing the PPH radio show, where we started to really be into, I mean, we would watch literally everything, and you would see Suzuki wrestle, oh god, who was the girl that he was linked with? She actually helped start Stardom, and it's gonna drive me nuts. I'll have to try to remember exactly who it was here. Anyway, regardless, but like, you know, you'd see him in these weird matches, and I'm thinking, wait a second, this is the dude who like snarls and like does leg locks, and he's like kind of like, he's like you said earlier on, the guy who no sells Irish whips is now wrestling like this woman or this, like, you know, whatever it is. But it's like he would have these great matches, like these wacky great matches. You know, they wrestled, Nosawa had a show. Nosawa Rangai had a show. It was like an appreciation show where he had Suzuki and Takayama wrestle as luchadors, and he's standing on the beach and out, like, this is like the purple haze coming out of the water, like Leviathan, Batista coming out of the water in OVW. All of a sudden, out of the water comes Suzuki and Takayama, and it's Dos Mil Siete Bellwood is Minoru Suzuki, and I forget what the hell was Takayama's name? I can't remember. Ray High Mountain was his name, King High Mountain. And they come out of the water, and they have a match where Suzuki is doing Lucha Libre moves. He's doing, like, the spin and the ropes. And it's like, wait a second, hold on now. Hold the phone on this. Like, this guy is amazing. It's like, this, I was completely, completely wrong about this cat. Completely wrong. And then from there, I mean, it just seemed to be like he was, I don't know, he wasn't involved anymore. He was still working as much, but like, you know, becoming a regular in All Japan and becoming a regular later on in New Japan and bouncing around and having access to all these places that he bounced around and being able to follow him. It's like, you know, he was always, in hindsight, I never gave him his credit. He was always good. But as time went on, like, I didn't give him his credit. He was good, but like he like got great. And like over the last, I don't know how many years, it's like, again, he was always really good, but he took it to another level of being great, you know, working with guys and always making everyone look good and being able to temper his style where he was still, you know, he was still the guy that, you know, you weren't going to get in every move on. There was still a level of believability that this guy wasn't going to cooperate on some things, and you knew he could at any time snap if he really wanted to, but just seemed to be like, I don't know, the entertainment value went up. And I know I just babbled on here for like 20 straight minutes or whatever, but like, I don't know. I've got such an appreciation now for Suzuki. And again, it was a slow climb to get there. And I really put a lot of the sins of Inokiism in hindsight. If you were to ever go back and find those old PPHs or anything like that, I really put him in the wrong category because I didn't understand him and I didn't understand what was going on. But over time, I really got to believe it. And then just his work with Suzuki Gun in Noah, in New Japan, you know, in Noah, you know, again, before Noah started to take the tumble, in All Japan, in New Japan over the last couple of years, and then going back to Noah, you know, with Suzuki Gun before they come back to New Japan. I mean, I thought everything was excellent. I really think he really has put himself into a Hall of Fame category.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it, and that was one thing I disagreed strongly with Bruce about, because when Dave put out his Hall of Fame, Bruce felt like Suzuki wasn't there yet. And for me, The only thing I'm waiting for, and it's not that I'm a, I am a big fan of belts, but I think just I'm a history fan with the belts. If he gets a shot at winning the IWGP heavyweight title and does it, the fact that you have someone that can go back to King of Pancrase, jump into All Japan, jump into New Japan, jump into Noah, and say they have been champion in all those avenues, that is such a weird freaking thing to have on your resume.
And it shows you how long he's been around, too. It's like you forget how long this dude has been around for, you know? I mean, he's 50 years old. 50. And I think the thing was, too, you know, he wasn't Takada. One, he had the win over Shamrock and all that. Certainly, again, I don't know. There's always that stuff with Pancrase of when it became real. Was it always real? Were only some of the matches real? Like, I don't even want to get into that.
Yeah, that's a line I always just put as, it's Chinatown, Jake.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, what the record's going to show is he beat Ken Shamrock. The record's going to show he beat Matt Hume. The record's going to show he beat Tiger White. You know what I mean? So it doesn't really matter. That's what that record is going to show. It beat Shamrock twice, you know? But so he had those, but it's not like he was a great fighter. It's not like he had that cachet outside of fighting that he was that dude. And he didn't have Takada's charisma. He didn't have that kind of star power. He was not a great fighter like a Sakuraba was. You know, he was not great at the hybrid style, nowhere near as great as like a Tamura was, you know, who I still think is the best at it. I really do. I think I think he is. But like he was never enough of, I think, anything. And early on, again, he coming in, unless you loved that stuff, I think there was a curve to try to get over with some of those guys. With the non-really charismatic guys, there was like, you know, like Takuma Sano stands out in New Japan when you have all these other guys, you know, at a time where you have your Doc Deans and Dean Malenko's and all these, you know, again, different type, you know, he stood out in these matches with Liger, you know, who was a flashier guy. It's like, it just, you know, I think it was a tough, you know, you see with Volkan, those votings and Tamura, like they're never going to get it in the Hall of Fame in all likelihood, unless they're put in a historical category, nobody's going to vote for them. And that's that's where Suzuki came out of. So he was already kind of working from underneath. And again, if you had the same, and I don't want to say bias, but if you had the same attitude I had where it was like that style invading Japan, in hindsight, was a needed thing that needed to happen because it was a natural evolution of things. But like for a wrestling fan who was a traditional wrestling fan, it pissed you off. It sucked, you know, and if you really love New Japan, you started to see these guys like, you know, your chonos not matter as much anymore because they were a little older and they couldn't fight, like really fight. And the guys who could were getting those pushes and guys, you know, those types of guys, you know, again, it was tough. And I don't think you could look at his work and that you really loved it. And I think it's been the last really 10 years, you know, more than anything. I think before that, there's no way, you know, he was ever going to be in the Hall of Fame, even 5 years ago. But I think in the last couple, with him getting better, almost seemingly getting better as he gets older and understanding more, you know, or at least I don't want to say understanding more. I want to, you know, his wrestling IQ was, you know, far much higher than mine. But I mean, name a shitty Suzuki match. Name a bad Suzuki match. Anytime recently. It's almost impossible.
It's tough.
Yeah. I mean, the Okada match was, you know, the second one was disappointing. And there was a lot about that match I didn't like, and I thought it was kind of disappointing how it went down. But, like, take that, you know, again, people, the reason it's disappointing, I bet you go back and watch that match in 3 years, you're going to say, God, this match was great. But, like, you know, in time and place right now, it's like, man, it's kind of disappointing compared to the last one. Well, shit, the last one was 5 stars. You know, it was, how many snowflakes do you want to attach to it? It was great. So it's like, you know, it's tough to go up from there. It's tough to, you know, to kind of match that at all times and everything. So, I mean, or I'm sorry, the match with Naito, I should say. I keep saying the match with Okada, the match with Naito that a lot of people were disappointed in. I mean, like, you know, yeah, they've had, you know, the last match they had was through the roof. The build that they had to the, you know, the feud was awesome. You know, you can't hit home runs all the time, but like, just what he was able to do with Naito, what he has been able to do tag-wise with Takashi Sugiura and Noah, that I think a lot of people, you know, his interaction with Sugiura, I thought was awesome. And I think Takashi Sugiura is one of the most underrated wrestlers, and he's cut from a cloth just like Suzuki, you know, amateur style. And I just, he's another great guy. But I think just what Suzuki's been able to do with almost everything he's touched, and his image and his training and his influence and all of that stuff, I think combined, I honestly think, again, you can debate it, and I could see why there would be people that would vote against him, but I think he has put himself, I think he's secured himself in that rarefied air for me.
Yeah, I look at it as not only has a wrestler, because I think the easy thing to say is look at the body work, but if you look at the influence of a pre-Suzuki Marufuji, if you look at the influence of Suzuki on wrestling in general, because now he's made a safe space for a guy like a Zack Sabre Jr. to be the king just tap out. He revitalized Taka freaking Michinoku's career as a hype dude.
He made that Yujiro like character. Yujiro was a character, but Yujiro in that clique being that dude, you know, when he was with him, you know, and they were all kind of like, you know, and then obviously, you know, but that little bit of time, like when they were together early on, you know, and he kind of like lingered around, and this is, you know, going way back. Like, I mean, he made him entertaining. He had matches with him that made him entertaining, for God's sakes. It's like, you know, and that's not easy to do. How many people have entertaining matches with Toru Yano? It was like limited to Tanahashi and Suzuki.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
And how do you, for me, when you say something like Gotch style pile driver, and you look at Suzuki and his history and his training and his lineage, there are very few people, and it goes back to your point about age, which is insane to me. Like, there's very few people who can say, I trace back. So for me, when I did the show on Saturday, one of the things I was looking for the future of Suzuki, and one of the things I need him to do is carry that forward. I don't know if it's a school. I don't know if it's finding a couple of guys and just taking them under his wing, but this has to carry forward for other generations. Like, my son just came in, and he wants to play FIFA at some point, so I'll have to give up the television. But he likes watching New Japan for the brightness of the matches. So he doesn't know all the characters. He doesn't know, like, he's not going to know Okada from, you know, Daryl.
But yeah.
When Suzuki comes on, he knows him because he's like, oh, that's the guy who took Daddy's picture and didn't choke him out.
That's it. I just kind of like thinking back now, like Adam doing those shows, we were doing these shows with like Suzuki again around when he was in All Japan, and there was that really weird time in All Japan, and I think I and maybe I'm romanticizing it too, but like All Japan was in such a bad spot after, you know, the Noah split, and then, you know, they gave everything, kind of handed the keys to the castle, handed over to Muda, and it's like there were pros and cons to that, but like, you know, in hindsight, one of the pros was the fact that like Suzuki, and you see this in a way now, even now with All Japan, like in their new resurgence, where it was like these guys from DDT and Big Japan would come over, and it's like, you know, they almost seemed like they were larger than life because you had people that may not watch those groups that were seeing them for the first time. It's like, I think that was kind of the feel too with Suzuki in All Japan, where it was like he was so much bigger there. He stuck out so much more. And because they had, you know, it was like Ryota Hama and Akebono, and like you had more gimmick guys like that, Rosie, like, you know, and Bull Buchanan. And it's like, you know, he stood out so much. You know, the guys who were really, really good stood out so much. And it's like, you know, I just remember doing those shows and thinking like, you know, imagine if he would go to New Japan. And then damned if he didn't go to New Japan and walked in there and, like, of all people, he jumps on Nagata, which was, like, again, you know, by that point, I completely understood the deal. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was like that whole, like, you know, the circle of life again, where it's just like, you know, I didn't have that same exact feeling when the Gracies came in, you know, a couple of years later. But like with Suzuki coming into New Japan, it was just like, man, this is going to be great. You know, and they had the, you know, the dome show match and everything. And then, you know, Suzuki Gun forms and boom. And then, you know, it's kind of off to the races with, like, you know, basically the, to me, the establishment, the official establishment of the Hall of Fame portion of his career, where it's like, you know, this is going to be the exclamation point. And it really was with that, the trip to Noah, where they dominated through Noah. And look, they didn't have an exit plan, and that's not his fault or anything like that when it came to Jado's booking over there with all that stuff. I mean, that, you know, it became a, you know, like the NWO, or like a lot of people think about the Bullet Club, where it's like it should have ended. And they should have had a way out, and they didn't. They Marufuji should have won the title from Suzuki, and that should have been done.
Right.
And I think they screwed up there, and they went on too long. All that sort of stuff, and they ended up making a mistake there. Everything seems to kind of be working itself back now, but like they did make a mistake there, but that's not his fault. And again, I think what they were able to do there, the fact they were able to build that kind of interest, I think, and then come back into New Japan and not miss a beat, I think just that. To me, it really has been the exclamation point.
Yeah, I am loving this final stage, Suzuki. I don't want him to leave, but he's also, like you said, 50 years old, and so I'm trying to enjoy him as he's here. Before we get out of here, Mike, because I know we could go on forever on the greatness of this man. What would you say are two really good matches? Like for me, you mentioned the second Noah run, and I think the first Marufuji Championship match. I think that's one match where you, if you want to watch a non-New Japan match of Suzuki and see, hey, can this work outside of this, watch that first match. I thought that was a really good representation. What about yourself? Any other matches stand out in his, I mean, we can go down the discography.
Well, like of a non-New Japan match?
Yeah.
I don't know, wait, which match?
I went with the first Marufuji match. So when
I'll go with Kobashi then.
Okay.
I'll go with it because there was the one from, oh crap, I'd have to look. It was around 2005 that I'd have to look up and see exactly what show it was on. It was not a dome show or anything like that because they wouldn't have been doing that then. But it was like the beginning. I can't remember. It was some sort of voyage that Noah was on because all their shows were something voyage. But like, It was from 2005 that was a pretty awesome one. I'm pretty sure it was. I gotta try to find this thing here, but like,
yeah, that was
that match was
Kobashi's 13th title defense, V13 versus Suzuki, January 8th, 2005.
That's it. Like that's an awesome match. Like that's a really awesome match. Said the Marufuji match. You know. Man, I would say that if you, for Comedy Suzuki, definitely try to find that Nosawa. It was Nosawa Produce 1 that had the stuff with him doing the lucha, because that was awesome. Like, that was really awesome. He had a couple of bangers, too, in All Japan with Taiyo Okea and with Suwama when Suwama was younger. That, you know, he had some good ones there, too. And unfortunately, I don't have that Alan Farrell type of Rolodex to go back. But, like, I mean, you know, him again, Suwama's progress was helped immensely by him too, and there was a lot that went into that, but like, you know, he had matches with Kea that were really good. He had matches with Kobashi again that were really, really good. With Katsuhiko Nakajima is another one too. When all that stuff was going on with Kensuke Office. And Nakajima was coming up, and it was, you know, because again, it's amazing to see Nawashi. The current Triple Crown champion that I'm just brain locking, Miyahara. Like, you know, coming from, like, you know, it's amazing now, like, that Kensuke Office, like, it was so wacky because he had, like, at the time, Kensuke was doing the Florida Brothers stuff, Andre, and Hokuto was around as like Hokuto became this cartoon character, you know, kind of posing with her man and with her baby, because it's like they had the weird family where it was like Nakajima was the kid and everything. But like, you know, at that time, you know, him and Suzuki too. I mean, I know they had matches where it's like, and I can't remember with Sasaki and Suzuki, if that, I would assume it was in Noah. I can't remember. Maybe it was Kensuke produced cards, but like, you know, he had good ones with him too. So it's just, there are plenty of them out there. I would just say, you know, again, from really like 05 on, 06 on, I guess really 04 on, in Noah, like almost from there, like just pluck a singles match, you know, as far as, again, but that wacky one, that really wacky match, I got to try to find that with the Ray High Mountain one, because that's one that not a lot of people saw. I don't think a lot of people have seen. And I think if you actually saw him doing, obviously it's, you know, it's Minoru Suzuki playing Lucha Libre, but to watch him do some of this stuff and see how light on his feet sometimes he can be, it's absolutely hilarious.
Awesome. And I just shared out, so that'll be kind of a timestamp for you guys to figure out when we recorded this, the Kobashi match, because there's nothing smoother than Kobashi in the black hoodie versus Suzuki with the towel over his head. It's that's a lot of manpower right there. Like, that's just, yeah, you don't want to see that match.
Part of me wishes, and like in some, in hindsight, like again, I'm happy. Like I had radio. It was like WCBM in Baltimore, WIP in Philadelphia, and WFAN overnight in New York on Saturday night. They all had a wrestling show on. And all of them leached from, like, the Torch and from the Observer. And I have a Torch somewhere from, like, 1987 or whatever it is. Wow. Of, like, you know, when, like, Wade appeared on, like, Larry Katz's wrestling show. And, like, I got, like, an issue, like, a free issue or, you know. But I never really subscribed to that stuff. So I, like, to see the All Japan stuff for so long, it was like, you know, it's like, what the hell is this? But, like, and like, you bring it, like, I wish... Part of me wishes in hindsight I could have, you know, experienced that stuff as it was going on, because, again, my introduction to Japan was later, you know, for the most part, like outside of, you know, seeing these guys if they came to America for a crossover, like, you know, Muda coming in or Chono going to Central States or something like that. I mean, you know, outside of that, it was hard to see those guys. And I'm jealous of the tape traders that had a chance to see the Masawas and the Kobashis and Kawadas and, you know, all of that stuff as it was going on in real time.
Wow. Well, Mike, we just went, if I can steal a Noah, we went on a voyage of discovery with Minoru Suzuki tonight. So before we get out of here, why don't you tell the fine folks where they can find you, all the outstanding work you do over at The Observer, and whatever social media you'd prefer them not to stalk you on.
You could find me, like, getting an oxygen tank somewhere, because I just realized how much caffeine I really had tonight. The random rambling promos of Minoru Suzuki, love here. Hopefully that was semi-coherent. And that's what I'm known for, semi-coherence. you can catch me, the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare, which hopefully we will be recording very soon whenever you hear this. It's always a crapshoot, but we're going to be hopefully having some shows here real soon, just so everybody can put themselves in time and place. The Best of the Super Juniors is going on. Miyahara and Marufuji just happened not all that long ago as well, too. We want to talk about that. Talk about all these wacky streaming services. Io Shirai leaving Stardom and making her way to WWE and all that sort of good stuff. And that's what we talk about on that show mostly. It's the muse is Japanese wrestling. We end up talking about raising babies and hockey games and whatnot, all that sort of stuff as well, too. So you can find that over at f4wonline.com, where I also do Wrestling Observer Live every single day. Why? I don't know. I really don't. But I do it with Brian Alvarez Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. on Saturday, 6 o'clock p.m., the mothership edition of the show. Sometimes it goes 2 hours. Other times it goes one. But you can catch that. Tune in radio all time. Just look for Sports Byline on Tune in Radio. That's probably the easiest way you can get us. There's about a zillion ways you can, including on Sundays on Sirius XM, Rush Channel 93, the fine people over there. American Forces Radio Network, if you happen to be in the service. I believe they play the replay every day. The Sunday is live at 6, and then they'll play the replay edition of the show at 8 p.m. Eastern time. So there you go. And I pop up in random other places, too, because I love, if as you could tell by this show, love the sound of my own voice.
Well, it is a voice well appreciated, Mike, and I thank you for being on the show.
There's a lot of Newports and bourbon that end up leading to this voice, so it's, I've worked hard at this one.
The train conductor special there, bourbons and some Marlboros as you go down the track.
That's with the Jack Buck. I think they asked him, it's like, you know, how did you get your voice? And it was like, you know, whiskey and menthols or something like that. And I am thankfully long past the menthol stage, much healthier that way. But, you know, you got to get a little bit of bass gravel in there somewhere.
Well, it's been good, man. I enjoyed it. Y'all enjoy this, I hope. You know how much I love Suzuki. Hopefully Wade didn't get sued by the artist. I can't recall her name right now because I opened my show Saturday with Kaze ni Nanare instead of the usual torch music, and I wanted to run through a wall.
Yumi Nakamura. Is it Yumi Nakamura? That's a wrestler. I can't remember.
I know. I thought her last name was Nakamura, but...
No, it is actually a Yumi Nakamura. So yeah, and it's, you know, she's 51. She came out there, and this was a couple years ago, so she would have been like 48, whatever.
Yeah,
it is like
Kingdom.
Yo,
yeah, she was a problem. She's up there with Ming Na Wen as far as like wait, what, how old are you? And okay, all right, good for you, ma'am.
See, and I'm out here saying like, man, you see Ma, like, she's like 8 years older than me. That's it now. Yeah. Like, I mean, just like, I gotta come to grips with the fact I'm old. Damn, I'm old. Man, can you imagine what it's like to be like Bruce then?
I know. I was gonna say, at 37, I'm okay with it, but Bruce has to be like ready to get on a Viking ship and have a flaming arrow fired at him.
It's like Bruce and Abe Jacobs are like hanging out somewhere right now. Abe Jacobs is that's a reference so old that like nobody knows what's going on there, but Bruce will know.
Oh, Bruce will know, and he'll be really angry about it. I called him venerable the first time I worked with him, and he was insulted.
I owe Bruce. Was he really insulted?
Not really. He was just. He's like, how dare you?
I was gonna say, as a teacher, you should have appreciated the fact you busted out venerable.
No, SAT word didn't work for me. He was like, that means old. It's like, no. You have appreciated, sir.
I remember I was so pissed off with Nakamura getting knocked out. I was so upset because he, and this is in, this would be 04, this was October of 04, that he won the title from Tenzan. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise win, and like, you know, it got a pop, but it was one of those like, what is going on here? And he got the belt, and basically they built him up to that match with Ignashoff, you know, on New Year's Eve, and they had the NWF title match, you know, set up also for January 4th against Takayama. And I just remember I wrote this rambling, because, I mean, as you could tell, that's all I did. So you can imagine me trying to just regurgitate words, you know, out on a piece of paper and moving them around like, you know, like finger painting or something like that. And God knows, Wade, bless him, you know, when he started the lounge and he did that nonsense of giving people doing show reviews a chance to speak their mind. What a fool that man turned out to be to do any of that. He unleashed me and Derek Bergen and a bunch of other degenerates on the world. But
so you guys basically kept Sean Radican in line until he just
Was our young boy for the longest time, and then we fled the territory, and unfortunately you got what you got out of him. That's what happens when you leave scorched earth. Like, they have to try to build, you know, around something, and we're sorry, you know, we apologize in hindsight, but like, you know, thankfully some other things grew around him. He wasn't just the cactus prickling there, sucking up all the water in the desert. You were able to make a little bit of hay out of it. But I wrote this, just, I was so pissed off. And it's like, I wrote this big thing about like, what if WWE did this? Like, what if Randy Orton, you know, who was young at the time, like, hey, let's have him face off against, you know, Ken Shamrock, or let's have, you know, this guy face off against like our toughest shooters in the company. You know, how much sense would this make? You know, comparing it to that. And I remember, I guess Dave reached out to Bruce, and basically, you know, the 50 trillion thousand word, you know, wall of text that I had up there, you know, Dave was actually able to kind of, I guess, disseminate and actually, you know, see the emotion and of like the ridiculousness in this day of age of what Enochism is, you know. And he reached out, and Bruce actually, you know, sent out word that, you know, like, Dave, you know, thought it was pretty good. And I remember that was like, I would always write stuff and wonder, like, because you never really get any, you know, sometimes you don't get too much positive back. Like, you know, sometimes the nice people don't say anything. You just hear from the assholes. So it's like, you know, at the time, it's like, man, who is reading some of this stuff? And I just went on a big rant. Nobody's going to care. And it was like, it was a very nice thing that, like, he didn't have to do. And, like, Bruce didn't have to reach out to tell me. But it was like, it was very, I don't know. It was just, it was some gasoline for the tank, I would say, at the time that I needed it to kind of keep me going on something. And I'm very happy I did. And that's one of the reasons, you know, for that reason, I'll always be very thankful to Bruce, who was always there with a nice word or to answer a question. And obviously we had the Mid-Atlantic thing in common and me coming up on Crockett and being influenced by that. But, you know, he was always very, I'm always very thankful that he was there for, you know, a word if I needed it. And I will never say anything bad. You'll never, ever, ever catch me saying anything bad. I don't think about Wade that at least is not funny. Because without Wade and without, you know, then Derek Bergen's support and stuff like that, I mean, I couldn't have been able to get to where I've gotten to and been able to do what I've been able to do. And I've been very, very lucky. And I know you create your own luck sometimes, too. But, you know, still, I'm very, very, very grateful to anybody that ever listened to me, cared about it or put me on. And Wade certainly did that.
Oh, well, that's all. I mean, Wade is definitely, I mean, all of them, they're going to listen to this at some point and see the Mutual Admiration Society. And Bruce, yes, the check did clear, so thank you for that. It's wild. It's wild. I enjoy this show mainly because I never thought 5 years ago I'd be doing it. I never thought 3 years ago. I never thought 6 months before he gave it to me I'd be doing it. It's just, I enjoy wrestling. I enjoy talking about wrestling, and I like the people I talk to about it. And so, hopefully, you guys enjoyed Mike and I talking about this stuff. And if you did, definitely hit him up at SemperVV. You can hit me up at Rich_Fan. And you can always email the show, pwtdive@gmail.com, if you have an idea or a subject you want to hit or a question you want to ask. Because this is run by y'all. I try to have fun with it, but I like to listen to my listeners. Mike, thanks again. Get some rest, and hopefully you don't have a Jesse Spano moment with the caffeine come down.
No, you just I'm just going to hook up the IV as soon as we get off of here. If you never let it go, it's like, you know, I'm pointing to my head right now. You know, if you never come down, you know, you don't have to worry about the crash.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, this show can be ad-free and commercial-free with a VIP membership. VIP members not only enjoy all 7 episodes of the PW Torch Livecast with no commercials and the ads and plugs edited out, but they also get ad-free additions to the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling post shows and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast. Also, part of a VIP membership and exclusive shows such as the Every Single Day Wade Keller Hotline, the 3 times a week Bruce Mitchell audio show, including a new weekly mailbag edition with Bruce, The Fix with Todd Martin that I also host, post-pay-per-view roundtables that I host, and other shows on specific topics, including the new Talking Honor podcast with Lola and Harley discussing the latest in ROH, including a review of the latest TV show. And now we are proud to announce that Alan Cunahan, known as Alan4L, has brought his talents to PW Torch after many years at The Observer, and there's a lot of excitement about his new weekly show called Alan4L's Pro Wrest Paradise, with the best coverage of New Japan, all of Japan, the UK indie scene, including the US indie scene. So be sure to become a PW Torch VIP member for as little as $8.25 a month on average, and have multiple new VIP exclusive and ad-free podcasts every day on customizable feeds on your iPhone and Android device. For more information and our sign-up form, go to pwtorch.com/govip, and you'll find out what else comes with VIP membership, including a weekly newsletter, over 1,500 back issues of the Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter that started it all, ad-free access to our mobile and desktop sites, and more. Full lineup, full details, and the sign-up form at pwtorch.com/govip.